We are preparing for some massive technological changes in the not-too-distant future, and we should start thinking about those now. Welcome back to another T-Rex Talk. This one is going to be a little bit nerdy, but it has some pretty significant implications for stuff on your immediate, practical to-do list. So let's get started. There has been a massive amount of technological development in your lifetime. You live in a post-internet world, and if you're roughly my age, you were born into a pre-internet world, and you had some level of pre-internet life. And the internet has changed things in ways that we're only now just sort of beginning to contemplate. Not only is the internet continuing to grow and develop, and there's new technologies all the time, but even just the implications of kids growing up with only the internet world as their experience, we're barely seeing what that even looks like because these kids are like still tiny babies. They're like, who knows what the TikTok generation is going to be like once they actually reach full maturity. But let's step back a little bit. So not only has the internet development been ridiculously super fast, I mean, you are listening to a podcast. Podcasts are so ubiquitous, it's hard to remember that podcasts are brand new. But almost all of the technology that we have on planet Earth right now is pretty brand new. I want you to think about the fact that, yes, our early forebears were probably way more technologically advanced than we think. We constantly dig up fascinating artifacts that defy caveman to modern man linear timescale thing. But I do believe that, for the most part, in the last several thousand years of human history, nobody traveled faster than a horse could run, and information didn't generally travel faster than a horse could run, unless it was like a carrier pigeon. Not entirely sure of the airspeed of a laden passenger pigeon, but anyway, we're talking about millennia of information and people traveling at roughly the same speed, and the amount of work and effort that you can do is magnified by having things like metal tools, but you're still never going to bring to bear more energy into a specific bit of work than you can do with your own two arms, or you can do with levers, or you can do with horses. And stuff really starts to change in the 1500s. And the first things that change are ideas. And those ideas get moved around because of a technological development called movable type printing. The Gutenberg press allows for ideas to travel a lot more widely. Not faster yet, but a lot more widely. The ability to print books en masse has a massive, massive effect on the world. And I think that is why there is this gigantic explosion of technological development, not immediately, not a year after books start being printed in the 1500s, not even a decade, but as there is a generation of people growing up in the post-printed book world, we start to see some pretty amazing developments. In the 1500s, massive ideological and political change in Europe, largely because of the technological power of the press. Obviously, the ideas have to be there, right? But the press just makes those things travel through society much faster. And then by the 1600s, you see people really building on that. And there are massive developments in art and in literature and in politics and in science. And the faster the ball rolls, the faster the ball accelerates. So you have guys like Kepler, which I'll come back to Kepler, and he is developing whole systems of physical understanding of the universe that Newton would build on. Newton is building on these things in ways that are kind of amazing. He predicted so much of the things that we didn't even have the tools to properly measure and verify until much later because of the foundations that were being built before he came along. There are craftsmen who are developing new ways of working with metals, and so we have the first really usable steam engine in 1712. 200 years after the Gutenberg press, roughly, we have a steam engine that can do actual work. And it's not super powerful, but it is a really easy way to pump water out of things, like mines. That steam engine is so useful that people are immediately working on improving it, improving the pressure that the different boilers can actually take so that you can use it to generate more power. And so So by the time that the 1800s roll around, you have steam engines that are really, really powerful. You are now able to bring a lot more force to bear for certain types of work than you ever could have done before with horses and oxen. Yes, having consistently running low-torque motors like that first steam engine is great for certain factory applications or mining applications, but being able to have a steam tractor with 10 horsepower, 20 horsepower, 30 horsepower, this changes the world. Because you can't just get 30 horsepower by hitching 30 horses up. You actually lose a fair amount of efficiency once you go above 2 or 4. But if you have a 50 horsepower steam engine that takes up less space than 4 horses, you can do a tremendous amount of work. So by the 1850s, you have steam tractors that are doing an insane amount of agricultural development, often in places where it hadn't really happened before. You have steam trains that are going long, long distances and pulling so much cargo that it totally changes the way that you can develop a country like America. You have steam ships crossing the ocean so rapidly, regardless of the weather conditions, carrying huge amounts of cargo with speeds that are consistent and dependable. This changes the world. And so, by the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of these technologies have really fueled a huge amount of civilizing development, mostly on the technological side. But I just want you to think about 1912, the Titanic is crossing the ocean. 100 years before, there were not really steamships doing particularly serious work. But in 1912, you have the Titanic. This thing is a luxury skyscraper crossing the ocean at 40 kilometers an hour, 25 miles an hour. Thousands of people are on board, and it has a radio that they can use to talk to America or Europe instantaneously. The tools that are available to human beings in 1912 are unbelievable. And remember, in 1903, the Wright brothers have already launched an airplane. Human flight has happened. We're only a couple of 100 years after the very first functioning steam engine. We're only 400 years after that very first movable type press that lets people disseminate their ideas on scientific discoveries, and we already have human flight. And then, even more amazingly, just 60 so years after the Wright brothers build this little tiny wooden canvas biplane, we have giant rockets putting men on the moon. That is a super short amount of time to go from figuring out powered flight to figuring out space flight. And also in the late 60s, we have some pretty significant computer development that has happened. And so people start working on networking those computers, and the very beginnings of the internet are born. And the internet is powerful, not because it does a huge amount of physical power, not nearly as much as those rockets or even those diesel locomotives that are pulling stuff around so that we can get all the materials to build the space program in one place. Those computers are very small, but gradually they grow in power and they grow in connectivity. Activity throughout the 70s and the 80s. And so in the 90s, computers are pretty common, and computers that are connected to one another are really common. And the information sharing, this giant leap in the ability to store and develop and share information with lots of people really quickly, sees this massive jump, possibly a jump the likes of which we haven't seen since the 1500s and that development of the Gutenberg press. Which is why I think that we have to use these tools very carefully. I've talked a little bit about the fact that printing presses are really important, but they can't just exist in a vacuum. There are definitely people in the earlier history who developed printing presses and movable type printing before, but it didn't turn into a radically civilization-changing, information-spreading tool if it wasn't used like that. The ideas had to be there to be spread. The tool didn't do that on its own. So we have ancient Chinese movable type printing that doesn't actually result in a huge democratized or decentralized Chinese empire. But that is what happens in Europe. As you know, I am a Christian, and not only am I a Christian, I am a Protestant Christian. I believe that the Reformation that happened in Europe is directly tied to a huge amount of this technological development. The ideas that were being presented by the early reformers and the ability to spread those ideas with this brand new printing technology creates a world-changing event. We go from this highly centralized church model, where all of the different nations and empires of Europe are underneath a central governing church authority, to something that is massively more decentralized. And there's a huge amount of ideological work and discussion and conflict, and sometimes real conflict as well, that happens immediately after that. And that is what I believe really paves the way for a huge amount of this scientific discovery and debate and discussion as well, and a huge amount of the free market competition that allows all of these little nation states, you know, not really very big or powerful, but the free market competition between them, when they become this decentralized and yet somewhat independently coordinated entity, creates for massive economic engines as they develop steam ships and steam trains and steam tractors and do the colonization thing. It is vastly more effective than the kind of thing that we had before with the more centralized model. And modern historians will point to an aspect of this where they look at Copernicus and they look at Galileo, and they pitch the whole thing as science versus religion. Those are the two guys who had the guts to fight back against the Pope and declare that the world is round and it goes around the sun and it isn't this flat, lame, ancient Bible interpretation. But that is actually not the entire picture. Those guys absolutely pushed back against the Pope. But the Pope wasn't convinced of some sort of geocentric model because of the Bible. He was a huge fan of Ptolemy, the ancient philosopher, and he did not want Ptolemy's good name besmirched by some of these new ideas about the world and the solar system. And it's also worth pointing out that Galileo and Copernicus were A, both religious, and B, both wrong. I mean, they're right about the Earth going around the sun in some sort of gravitational model, but they got the model completely wrong. They got the math completely wrong. The guy who got the math right was Johannes Kepler. And Johannes Kepler was not a science versus religion guy. He was a religion commands us to do science properly because science helps us understand the Creator and understand religion properly. That was his thing. And he was so good at both that his science was amazing. He's the guy who wrote all of the physical laws that Newton was able to build on top of. And his mathematical model of how space works is so good that his model is what we actually used to send out all of those rockets that went to the moon. When you look at this stuff, it's really easy to see the big, powerful technological tools and the immediate effect that they had on the environment or the economy or whatever. But the ideas are really what drive those things. Not only do they drive the people to actually want to come up with solutions for specific issues, but they also create the civilizations that have the ability to do the technological work. The ideas come first. And oftentimes you have guys like Kepler creating ideas and models and systems that become practically useful when the technology catches up, rather than the other way around. So where does that leave us? I'm not expecting anybody listening to this podcast, and least of all me, to go out and do the kind of work that Johannes Kepler did. Go over hundreds of thousands of handwritten constellation observation data and develop entirely new mathematical processes for describing ellipses and calculating circular things. But he himself was the product of a school of thought that said that individual people are allowed to do this. Human beings have freedom. He was the product of a whole bunch of ideological ideas that had broken up this very top-down centralized control of academia and many nations in Europe. He was a product of that decentralized, liberty-based thinking that had come from the Reformation. And there were some technological helps that he had along the way. I think that as soon as Europe was able to start going out to get coffee beans and tobacco from the New World, this combination of printed books, solid ideas, caffeine and nicotine, all that worked really well together in that 1600s period to get a ton of stuff figured out and a ton of stuff done. But it was built on the ideological foundations of decentralization and liberty first. That is what enabled all the other stuff to happen. Whether you are talking about the science of developing these models and the tools. Whether you are talking about the economic frameworks, whether you are talking about the literature and art that came out of that period, it's very easy to point at the Catholic artists of the Counter-Reformation and say, yes, the Renaissance was amazing because of those guys. And those guys were amazing. But there was also a huge amount of artistic development that is coming out of the Dutch masters and artists throughout Germany. And there's a huge amount of literary stuff that is going on, just pouring out of England. The amount of development, cultural, civilization, ideological development that is happening at this time is phenomenal. And we shouldn't ignore that when we just focus on the technology stuff. And that's important for us now because I believe that there's a huge amount of technological stuff that has changed, and we haven't really seen the implications of it quite yet. And there's a whole bunch of technological breakthroughs that are coming. And we need to start preparing for those, even though, man, it's hard to predict what they're actually going to be. I got four in particular that I want to bring up for you to kind of mull over. The first is AI, which is kind of dumb and obvious because everyone's talking about AI at the moment. It turns out that the stuff that we thought AI would be good for, really calm, dispassionate, cold clinical calculation of tons of logical facts, is not actually what our current AI models are good at. They're really good at drawing pictures and writing songs and imitating Johnny Cash. That is the thing that AI is better at than most people. And the practical implications of that are a little hard to picture at the moment. And there's a bunch of people who are predicting all kinds of stuff. Some people are predicting an entirely new renaissance of everybody being an artist, everybody being a musician, everybody just being this incredibly creatively empowered individual because of these tools. And then other people are predicting this very dark Terminator Matrix future where AI decides that we are as useless as ants and just kills all of us because they're optimizing the entire universe for an AI model. That is the other possibility. And I actually think that what's going to happen is more positive. It's going to be somewhere in between the two. Software engineers are convinced that AI is ridiculously powerful because they believe that software is ridiculously powerful. And it is, but they have kind of this Oppenheimer-esque attitude of like, I am hugely powerful and I have invented a thing that is even more powerful than me. Oh, the terrible burden of this guilt and my sheer awesomeness terrifies me. And mechanical engineers and people who work in the physical world are like, yeah, software is kind of useless and it's a huge pain to work around and it's not creating killer robots anytime soon. I create killer robots. Software engineers can't figure out how to control them. I'm not worried. So I'm not predicting that metal endoskeletons tramp over the skulls of human beings anytime soon. But AI is remarkably powerful, and we haven't figured out exactly how to focus the power yet, and that in and of itself is kind of a big deal that merits a lot of careful consideration. Second thing I want to mention is quantum computing. Quantum computing is approaching quickly. And we know that it's going to be drastically different than our traditional silicon binary computers, but we haven't really grasped the full capability of a quantum computer because it is so different. One of the things that will immediately happen once we have quantum computers that are functional and powerful is probably the end of standard encryption. You will be living in a post-encryption world as soon as quantum computers have any real horsepower to them. Now, the good news is that encryption and cryptology and codes have always been an arms race. It's always been this constant technological battle where people develop stronger codes, and then somebody else develops stronger code-breaking techniques. And then somebody develops even stronger codes still, and then somebody comes up with better code-breaking tools for those. So as soon as we have quantum computing tools that break our existing 256-bit AES encryption, we will have people working on quantum encryption. So the arms race will continue. But quantum computing will allow us to do other stuff too. It is so new and it is so fluid and it is so ripe with possibilities, it's really hard to predict them. But quantum computing is a great example of a tool that I think will have tremendous capabilities if used wisely and tremendous downsides if used improperly. Just like all technology is neutral. Now, some of it's harder to use for good than others. Some of it's harder to use for evil than others. But it is how the technology is used that really matters. Quantum computing has the capability to help us build a vastly more decentralized technological society. It solves a whole bunch of the issues that we are currently running into with routing traffic on the internet. The way that we use the internet now requires massive centralizing servers to actually serve the data, but also just guide and steer the traffic from my computer when I upload this podcast to your device when you listen to this podcast and all of the little tiny network devices in between. Routing these things directly from my device to yours in a truly peer-to-peer way is an almost impossibly complex math problem. But a quantum computer could probably handle that. A quantum computer might be the best possible way to do this large global mesh internet without centralized infrastructure and switching. Those insanely complicated pathfinding algorithms to figure out how the data from this podcast should end up coming out of your phone is probably child's play to a quantum computer that is optimized to do that. So quantum computing could be used to decentralize this huge, complex network switching problem that is the modern internet, and the even bigger problems that will be the future internet. On the other hand, if we use quantum computers solely as a way to more centralize power and more enable surveillance inside of large centralized governments, it's going to have the opposite effect on humanity as a whole. So that's just one example of this technology is either going to be used to radically shape the entire world in one really positive direction, or the other way. The third really powerful technology that I think we're right on the edge of seeing is superconductors. Now, people have been talking about the emergence of room temperature, ambient pressure superconductors for my entire life. But remember that my entire life, compared to the sweep of human history, most of which we've spent on horseback, that is really, really short. And there's some new research that's just come out this year showing pretty good evidence that we can create superconductors that operate at room temperature and in ambient pressure. And superconductivity is one of these things that has been talked about a lot. It has all sorts of applications, but until you actually start using them to solve problems and do real, actual physical work, we're not even going to know all the stuff that they can do. But essentially, we would be able to create devices that have no electrical resistance as they do electrical stuff. We could build computers that are super powerful using very little power, whether they are traditional computers or presumably quantum ones. And then the magnetic properties mean that we could build relatively frictionless bearings for all sorts of load-bearing surfaces. Is it as big a deal as the first steam engines? I don't know, but nobody knew how big a deal the first steam engines would be until people had squeezed hundreds of horsepower out of them and put them on tracks and wheels and sent them all over the world to convert vast chunks of uninhabitable land into lush gardens, and then built trains so people could get there quickly, and then built boats so that people on the other side of the world could get there quickly. It is something that we'll kind of have to see to figure out, but the implications are pretty huge. And then the fourth one is fusion power. Fusion power, whether it's hot or cold fusion, to generate electricity, is something that scientists have been talking about for my entire relatively short life. But again, there are some relatively promising experiments and results that have come about just in the last couple of years. There's a huge debate right now that is raging over climate change and energy stuff that is really, it's supposed to be the next big thing, trademark. And the way that we talk about climate change, man-made climate change and how we need to combat it has been one of the single most distracting and centralizing debates over the last 30, 40 years. Giant government institutions must be created. Giant centralized government alliances must be empowered to solve this problem. Power needs to be taken away from the people, and small, decentralized, free market scientists must be squashed a little bit because the fate of the planet depends on them not inventing anything that is too cool, like another Dodge Charger, for example. But if fusion power is as good as it is supposed to be, and cold fusion comes along as quickly as it might, then that completely changes and takes away that particular current thing. Which brings us back to the original thing that I was trying to say. The ideas have to come first, or more importantly, the ideologies have to come first. If the assumption is that we need to create gigantic, vertical, centralized, global governments to control people, well then, we're going to apply that argument and those presuppositions to whatever technological developments come out of these fusion labs. But if we develop an ideology that is focused on human liberty and human flourishing at the individual level and not the giant top-down globalist level, we're going to look at clean, safe, localized power grids a totally different way. So we got all these technologies that are on the way, and they have the ability, they have the potential to be massively disruptive, not only to the existing way that we do power, and the existing way that we do computers, and the existing way that we do cars or whatever. They have a massive disruptive potential to the way that we do government and civilization. And you can see this when you look back through history and you see the massive power that movable type printing and steam engines had on the way that we do government and the way that we do human flourishing. But in the 1600s and 1700s, the ideology had to come first. And it didn't predict all of the technological stuff that was going to come along, but it built the presuppositions in which that stuff was valuable. There certainly have been societies in history that have developed amazing technologies like movable type printing and decided that it just did not help the government accomplish any of its goals. And it disappeared for hundreds of years until it popped up again in the middle of Germany, in the middle of a debate that made a lot of people say, this movable type printing thing, very helpful for our goals, very helpful for the direction that we want to move forward. Let's instantly put this thing into practice. So if you're listening to this podcast and you are not an AI scientist, you're not on the cutting edge of quantum computing development, you're not personally making superconductors in your kitchen, and you don't really know what the implications of fusion power are going to be, don't worry. The work that we need to do now is that ideological development, those presuppositions that will guide the way that these technologies are applied, and be ready for the vast changes that are potentially coming down the pike. There's going to be a whole bunch of climate control guys that try desperately to stay on top of this argument that they've had for the last several decades, this argument for total government control, even once fusion power appears. And they're either going to get control of fusion power itself, or they're going to be left in the dust as people take it in another, more positive, more productive direction. And that is the thing that this ideological preparation, as you think about this stuff, and you go back and you study history and you learn the lessons of the ideological movements that actually created the conditions for these technologies to actually benefit mankind, and not even mankind, but specific individual human beings, then you will have a better idea of how to be prepared for new world-changing disruptive technologies that are coming down the pike. But one of the main lessons that you will see is the one that I just mentioned before. Changes happen faster and faster and faster all the time. The time between people developing this technology and that technology has shortened as that scientific ball has gotten up to a lot of speed. The scientific ball that we have rolling down the pike right now, I think, was really given most of its energy, most of its push by guys back in the 1500s and 1600s, guys like Kepler, guys like Newton, who were enabled and empowered and motivated and set up for success by, well, the reformers and the people who brought them their coffee and tobacco. Those guys were standing on the shoulders of giants, and those are the giants that current scientists are standing on top of as well. The difference is that we don't have the ideological foundations and the ideological thinkers really working through some of these presuppositions. So the scientific ball is rolling without the same level of push and the same level of support from the regular people. But the scientific ball is going to keep rolling either way. And there will always be governments that try to direct it. China's Great Firewall of China is a perfect example of this. Or the modern FDA and CDC trying to grab a hold of some sort of pandemic rhetoric so that they can shape the narrative and declare themselves to be literally the science. But it is the people who actually use this technology and actually think the thoughts and do the work that develop the ideological conditions that will allow those sorts of centralizing ideas to flourish or not as these new technologies come along and as they are put into effect. So start thinking about this stuff. That is your homework assignment. Think about the last 6,000 years of Earth history and the incredible speed that this giant technological boulder is rolling right now. And think about all of the ideological movements and thoughts and people who have directed that boulder in the right directions in the past, and the ideological movements and centralizing nations that have tried to move that boulder in the wrong directions in the past. Think about the incredible benefits that have come from that boulder, the huge speed, power, and inertial energy of that boulder. But also think of the incredible damage and misery caused by that boulder going in the wrong directions. And then, you know, start thinking about quantum computing, superconductors, fusion power, stuff like that. We are going to see massively disruptive stuff happen way faster than once every five generations, like back in Gutenberg's time, and not once every two generations, like back in the 1700s. Not every generation, like in the 1800s. We're going to see it every decade or so, like in the last few decades. And I think that all of these tools are going to just speed that boulder up faster. So let's get working on our part.